This is the Wheeler Centre podcast.
Okay, I have the enormous pleasure of introducing you to Kate DiCamillo. I've had a little bit of a chance to get to know her in the green room, and she is as delightful as her books, I'm happy to report.
In small doses, that's what my mother would say.
We've got an hour. We can keep up with the delightful within the hour space. And I was chatting to Kate about how incredibly popular she is here, as you can see by the amount of people who've turned up tonight. So I feel absolutely no pressure to do a really good job tonight.
Thank you all for being here. It's so nice.
It's really wonderful. Yeah. So, Kate, as you're probably aware, we always like to start off with presentations like this to make sure that we honour and respect the people who were here before us. So I'd like to acknowledge that we're meeting here today on the traditional lands of the Kulin Nation and pay my respects to their elders, past and present. So I want to start with an introduction to Kate DiCamillo for people who may need a little bit of a refresher. She's the author of many award-winning books, including Because of Winn-Dixie, which is one of my favourites, Tale of Despereaux, Flora and Ulysses, and the Mercy Watson series. She's the former American ambassador for young people's literature and is one of only six people to win two Newbery medals. Her most recent novel, Ramey Nightingale, which is right here, is, according to Kate, the absolutely true story of my heart. And I think this is a really great...
That sounds very serious, doesn't it? Yeah.
Well, I think this is a really great place to start because, and a lot of you here would probably agree with me, I think if I was going to use one word to sum up everything I've read that you've written, heart would probably be that word. There is so much heart in everything you write. And why is it that, can we start with Ramey Nightingale, why this is the true story of your heart? Can you give us a little bit of a refresher on that?
Wow. I wonder if y'all remember being in college and you had blue book exams where you had to fill out a whole little small book with the answer to one question. That sounds like one of those questions.
So I it's like, in the hard one, yeah.
Why is it the true story of my heart? Well, Ramey Nightingale... So I became national ambassador. Let me start there. And in the course of being national ambassador, I had been going around for a long time and talking to large groups of children, but I never had like a presentation. It was more just me talking with the kids. And so I had to get a formal presentation because now I was an ambassador and it sounded important. And so I have a PowerPoint presentation where I talk about how I became a writer and part of that is who I was as a child. And so in that PowerPoint presentation, I have a picture of my mother and my brother and me, and I say to the kids, who's missing in this photograph? And they say, your father. And so I stood up all over the country and said that truth to kids, and then that truth is then turned into... this book about, you know, my father left the family when I was 6 years old. And that's just one of the things that I've turned over and over and over for my whole writing life. And we were talking backstage about how writing kind of puts you back together again, you know. And so that's one of the things that I've been lucky enough to be
In a lot of your stories, there's a parent missing, but it often tends to be the mother, particularly because of Winn-Dixie.
Right, and my mother's the one that stayed, and I think that you sometimes do things in a mirror image kind of way in order to make it more emotionally safe for yourself.
And the fathers are very present, and they're very kind. Were you creating a father for yourself, maybe?
Wow, we're going to do therapy on stage, isn't it? You know, it's funny, no one has ever said it that way, but sure, I bet you I was, yeah.
Well, we were chatting, and this might be interesting for some of you guys sitting up the front, but certainly I've been writing for a long time. I think you were always a big reader, and you wrote as a child as well?
Oh, no, I never wrote as a child.
It's
funny
because...
You just
wore the black turtlenecks. Pardon? You just wore the black turtlenecks.
Well, I was a young adult then, but as a kid, and it's interesting to me because things have changed so much, and maybe you've seen this too, where I love to read, and books to me were the most magical thing in the world, and I just didn't think that human beings had anything to do with them,
yeah.
you know? And it wasn't like now where you could meet a writer or writers came into schools. That just didn't happen when I was growing up. And so when I go into schools or when I meet kids, I think this is the one thing I can tell you. Look at me. I am a big mess. And yet I get to do this magical thing. So I feel like that's like the one message that I can deliver. But no, I didn't write, but I read and read and read
yeah.
as a kid.
And,
yes.
and still read a lot. But interesting that a lot of your characters are quite broken in a sense. Well, they're certainly quite vulnerable. And in the case of Despereaux, he's actually becomes broken, physically broken. And even Flora's mother in Flora and Ulysses says that something, I've got the quote here, she says something along the lines of, the world is not kind to the strange. So are you writing books to connect with people to... I guess, in a sense, show them that it's okay to be strange, and that's actually quite a beautiful, that we're all cracked and we're all broken.
I surely that message comes across, and but I never think this is what I'm trying to say, because if I think this is what I'm trying to say, then I'm going to ruin the story. And you
didactic.
Probably know that as well as I do. So I am aware of things out of the corner of my eye, but I think, ooh, don't look at those things, mm-hmm. because you might mess this up. So I'm always kind of doing it without looking at it directly. Does that make sense?
It does. And I think even the act of reading is almost an act of compassion in a sense, isn't it? Because you're forced to imagine what it's like to be someone else. I remember, some of you may know this book, the Roald Dahl book, The Magic Finger, where... Huh. Did you grow up reading Roald Dahl?
It's so funny. Roald Dahl was not in the school library or the public library.
Ina Blyton wasn't really big in the US either,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah. And so I didn't get Roald Dahl until I was an adult. Mostly I got James and the Giant Peach as a kid. But and then I read everything that he'd done as an adult and thought... I want to do this.
Yeah.
It's like, yeah, how do you get away with that?
Yeah. But well, he pushed the boundaries.
Yes,
definitely.
Yeah, he did. He's brilliant.
Yeah. But there is almost a sense of reading as a sense of trying to understand what it's like to be someone else in the world and perhaps understand yourself. And there's a lot of empathy in your books. And I think particularly in The Tale of Despereaux, there's just a little piece here I wouldn't mind reading that I think is such a beautiful summary of empathy where the Princess P... I'll read it out. It says, reader, I'm pleased to tell you that the pea was a kind person, and perhaps more important, she was empathetic. Do you know what it means to be empathetic? I will tell you. It means that when you are being forcibly taken to a dungeon where you have a knife pointed at your back, when you are trying to be brave, you are able still for a moment to think of the person who is holding that knife. You are able to think, oh, poor Meg. She wants to be a princess so badly. She thinks this is the way. Poor, poor Meg. What must it be like to want something that desperately? That, reader, is empathy. And it feels like all your books have this incredible sense of trying to understand what it's like to be complex and complicated. And so what was reading for you when you were growing up? Was it a friend or was it an escape? How important was it?
It was everything to me. It was how I made sense out of the world. I don't remember thinking of it as escape. I think of it more... as like it was the doorway in. And as an adult even, I find that it is me, that it's like I am most in my body when I am reading a book. Mm. It is just the way that I make sense out of the world.
And how is it different writing? Is reading a more pleasurable...
Oh, reading. It's funny because the group of kids that I talk to today, a kid asked a question that I've been doing this now for, I don't know, 17 years. And a journalist just this year asked me, do you read more or do you write more? And I thought, that is such a good question. And then a kid today asked that question. And that's the first time a kid has ever asked it. And I read... way more than I write, and reading is pleasurable and writing is very difficult for me.
Mm.
And I always feel like there's a gasp of horror that goes up from the teachers when I quote Dorothy Parker. I hate writing. I love having written, but it's a really important distinction because I think it's that way for a lot of things that are, you know, important and meaningful. You have to push yourself to do it, and it's not easy.
So you are pretty disciplined from what my research has uncovered.
Rigid is what my friends say. Yeah.
Two pages a day.
Yeah.
What keeps you turning up to your desk?
What keeps me turning up to my desk? Again, we're right back in therapy land, I'd say. Because I am so much happier when I'm writing than mm-hmm. when I'm not writing, but that's not to say that I'm happy when I'm writing. So it's just like, it's my days start, I like to get up before anybody else is up. When it's dark, I have I love the coffee in Australia. I have a coffee maker that goes off automatically, and I come downstairs around a little bit after 5. I pour the coffee, I go in, and I write the 2 pages before I do anything else. And I have found that we all, I think, have a voice in our head that says, you can't do this. Mm. You don't know what you're doing. You're not really any good at this. And for me, that voice gets up at about 9 o'clock in the morning. So if I get up when I'm supposed to, and you need that voice. You need that voice when you're editing. Mm. But I don't need it when I'm writing. So I'm always trying to get out of bed before that voice shows up and get the work done.
And then you got the rest of the day to yourself.
Well, then all the business of writing right. comes in for the rest of the day. But it's the same feeling I had before I was published, when I would go off to a job after I did the writing. There was this kind of this blissful, I've done the thing that matters. Mm. And now the rest of the day can be given over to you know, these things which are important, but the thing that sustains me has been done.
Mm. Yeah. And they do often talk, there's a little bit of research that talks about that very early morning mind is quite malleable and quite fresh, almost like a dream state.
Right, you've got a foot in each world. And that is also, and I say this to the kids too when I talk to them about writing, that's what works for me. Everybody's mind is different. Everybody's writing journey will be different. So that doesn't mean that you have to do 2 pages a day. It doesn't mean you have to do it first thing in the morning. There's no right way to do it. The only wrong way is if you want to do it and you're not doing it.
Mm. And when you're traveling, because you tour quite a lot, you just keep a journal? Is that what you keep
right,
your ideas?
That's yeah. right. You have done your research. Yes.
And I remember when I was at school, all my teachers would always tell me, you know, that I had to plan and I had to write notes in journals, and I never saw the point of it. I just wanted to write the story first off. So maybe for some of the younger people in the room, what does writing in a journal do for you?
Writing in a journal, what I find is one of the best things it's given me is I can go back, say, to when I was writing Despero, and I can find, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm never going to make it through this story. I will, and so you find that you can make your way through things. It's right there written in your own hand that you never thought that you would. And it also allows, so much of writing seems to be subconscious for me. And so, then very briefly in the journal, I can address the story consciously and then let it sink back down again. So that's one of the things I do journal.
Yeah, well, I've always got notebooks on me with everything from shopping lists to
yes,
to my ideas.
Right.
Yeah, and everything gets in it, doesn't it?
Right,
you know, the
it does.
Shopping list.
Yes. Yeah.
And does it get easier then? So if you're looking back through the journals and you think, oh my goodness, I found this so hard when I first started out. It
no,
does
it? Has it gotten easier for you?
No, I think if anything, you put more pressure on yourself.
Yeah, I was right before I left the States to come here. I was with a friend, and we were going past some men who were building a wall. And I said, "Man, I would love to know how to build a wall." And then you could get better with each wall, and you could look at it and see that's a good wall, right? You know, it's just like there you laid the bricks right, and everything's. But it's not like that with writing. You don't, you know, each time. All you know is that you've written a novel before. You don't know if you can write this novel, right?
And I think that that never goes away. I remember reading a quote about Peter Carey, who's a very accomplished writer who lives in America, and him saying at the very beginning of every novel he's plagued with doubt and he never believes he'll be able to do it again. So how do you overcome that? Do you just force yourself to write in that kind of that mind that's quite dreamlike and just keep pushing through that, or do you have another way that you approach that?
I that early morning thing, and then also telling myself Okay, this is the first draft. It can be just an absolute mess, that's fine. And then, okay, this is the second draft. I've got lots of drafts to go. I don't need to worry about me. And so I typically, I don't know how you work, but I typically do 7 drafts of a novel before it goes to my editor.
That's always amazing to hear, isn't it? I know when I speak in classrooms that that's very daunting for kids, isn't it?
Yeah, and you know, and I quote to them, do you know the book Art and Fear?
No, I don't know.
But it's by 2 visual arts professors. Their names are Bales and Orland, and they it's a wonderful book on creating, and they talk about how there's one Mozart born every century, somebody who hears the music and puts it down on the paper, and they say, you know, that's not you. If you want to make art, you're going to have to make mistakes and do the work of it. And I think that sometimes people think this is not just kids, this is kids and adults. If I'm supposed to do something, well, then it will come out right the first time. If I'm talented, then I can sit down and write a novel. Mm. But
it's just work.
Yeah, it's work. It's
and
work.
Do you find, too, I find that sometimes when I'm running workshops with young kids, that the younger they are, the less self-conscious they are and the more likely they are to take risks. And then something happens in about high school where they start to question themselves or they take themselves a little bit more seriously. Do you see that a little bit when you're doing workshops with kids?
I do. And we become more and more afraid as we age.
Yeah. It's like Picasso said, he works very hard to regain that child part of himself.
Right.
And do you think there's something about writing for children that means that you're in touch with that child part of yourself, which I think of as a sense of awe, really? It's like every time you walk down a street, you're seeing it as if for the first time. And a lot of travelers feel like that too, don't they?
Yeah, that's the great thing about traveling is it reminds you of that. But I also think, I remember when I did one of my very first interviews because of Winn-Dixie, which was the first book, was published. And I remember the interviewer leaning towards me. It was on public TV in Minnesota and saying, how do you get into the mind of a 10-year-old? And I was just so kind of gobstopped by the question because the answer to me was so obvious. Well, I was a 10-year-old. Mm. But I have found that for whatever reason, and I don't know why it is, that 10-year-old is very much at the surface for me. And I don't have to, it's not work for me to access that kid.
Yeah.
She's right here.
You travel a little bit as a child, too. Do you think that the travel has marked that part of your childhood, too, that there's something about having traveled that concretes something in your memory?
I don't know. That's interesting. No one's ever asked that before. Let's say yes. Yes.
I'll go with that. Sorry. Well, it's almost like if you've just been in the same place your whole life, there isn't anything that really signposts when you were 6. Oh, that's right. When I was 6, I lived in Florida.
I stayed in Florida for a long time, but it's interesting because I think I was born in Philadelphia, and then we moved to Central Florida when I was 6 years old, and it's very different culturally. And for instance, in the South, you would only address adults as ma'am or sir. And so I heard a lot of ma'am, and I'd never heard that word before. And I remember I thought it was just a universal term of respect. I just said ma'am to Mr. Duncan down the street and everybody, you know. But I was like Alice down the rabbit hole. Mm. And that served me very well, I think.
How old were you when you moved to
I was 6. Yeah. And it was just like, this is a whole new world. And I was just at the right age where it wasn't intimidating, but rather fascinating.
Yeah, great. What were you like as a child?
Terrified. Yeah. And shy and worried and also astonishingly good at making friends, which was the thing that saved me. Mm. Yeah, I was able to connect, and that was a wonderful thing.
And are there parts of you in your book? So one of the things I find most interesting about your books, and everybody here will be familiar with them, is there are a lot of animal characters in your books.
Yes, it's become ridiculous, really. It's like if you list them all off, I'm sorry. Yes, yeah.
I don't think anyone's got a problem with that. what is it about using animals? What is it that an animal character can bring that using a human can't?
There's no doubt that I think that as readers, we're much more likely to let down our guard for an animal character. But it's not that I do it that for that reason. I mean, part of it is just because I love animals. Mm. I thought I wanted to be a veterinarian when I was a kid until an unfortunate incident in the vet's office, which gave me some insight into who I was and what I was capable of and not capable of, involving a German Shepherd and a misplaced eyeball. It's like, yeah, I can't do it. But I've also, in talking about this all the time, because this comes up all the time, I think that when I think back to, and I read everything when I was a kid, but so many of the books that I loved had animal protagonists. Mm. There was Paddington and Stuart Little and
Charlotte's Web,
which I did not read as a kid.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. I know. It's terrible. I read Black Beauty as a kid. And so from that point on, I would not read a book that had an animal on the cover. I looked at the cover of Charlotte's Web in the library every week and thought something terrible is going to happen to that pig, and I'm not having anything to do with it. And then I was in a writing workshop of writing for children, and the teacher said to me, you have no business writing for children unless you read this book. And then she quoted the first line, which is, "Where's Papa going with that axe?" And I thought, it's going to be even worse than I thought, you know? So I did not come to it until I was like 30-something years old, and I reread that book every year, thinking, you know, trying to figure out how he did that, how he makes one word do the work of 10 words. Mm.
And just the characters being so defined as well, I think it's, you know, the geese are so different to the rat.
Right, yeah. It's a stunner of a book. How many of y'all have read that?
Anyone in the front?
And yeah. I find that, and talking to school kids for the last 2 weeks, most of them know it too.
So one of the things that I do love about Charlotte's Web that I also love about your books is the use of language. So the spider picks out random words from a newspaper and puts them into the web, which eventually saves Wilbur. And almost in each book there's a word, I guess, that becomes the word for the book. And I'm thinking of Carpathus, for example, for Flora and Ulysses, which is such a beautiful word. And if you can maybe talk to some of the younger people in the audience about what that means to you, Carpathus, because it's a complicated word, but it describes something quite beautiful.
Yeah, Carpathus is able to contain a huge amount of something, and it's all of the words that I learned, I learned from reading, and this was in a beautiful William Maxwell short story, and that ends with this is the quote at the end of the book of the story, which I love. If indeed we are all in God's hands, what capacious hands they must be. Mm. And I just fell in love with that word, and I kind of tucked it away and thought, I'm going to save it and use it for something, I don't know what. And then it showed up in Flora and Ulysses, and to describe Flora's father's heart, capacious. And that is my goal always, is to be capacious of heart, and I think it to myself sometimes. Yeah. Yes, yeah.
I think you've achieved it.
I'm working on it. Yeah. I'm working on it.
It's a constant practice, isn't it? Yeah. And that's how Flora saves herself in the book too, when her mother says that life, she's too strange for life. She says, well, I might be strange, but I'm also capacious and lovable.
Yes.
And is it that we relate to? Do you think it is the lovableness in the characters that are strange?
I don't know. I just know that I've been like extraordinarily, it is an astonishing thing to get up early in the morning to sit in a dark room and write a story and to be able to connect with people that you have never met. It is the most amazing thing in the world, and it is a magic that I do not understand. I just feel really, really grateful for it, but I don't know how it happened, you know?
Well, because of Winn-Dixie was your first novel, and you said that this was one that was a bit of an experiment for you, that you had been, I'm just guessing from putting all the pieces together, trying something a little bit more serious, a little bit more earnest, and then there's this beautiful lightness of touch in Winn-Dixie that appears in a lot of your work. It's very heartfelt, but it's really funny too. And what was it about because of Winn-Dixie that kind of just put you into this very comfortable place of creating this story?
Oh, I wrote because of Winn-Dixie when I had moved from Central Florida to Minnesota, where I live now, and part of where that book came from was a homesickness for the South, because It's very cold in Minnesota, and I can't do it in Celsius, but it's it will get 30 degrees below zero Fahrenheit in the winter there, which means parts just fall off your car when you open the door. It's just because they're frozen. And so when you see that, when you grew up in Florida and you watch the parts fall off your car, you think, I want to go home. Mm-hmm. And I missed the southern cadences. Mm-hmm. And so Opal's voice is very much a southern voice. And so it was hugely comforting to me to write that story. And it was also the first time in my life that I'd been without a dog, which is the other place that story came from, was I could not have a dog. I was experiencing what I call dog withdrawal. So like if I was in a car and there was a dog in the car next to me, I would beep the horn and wave at the dog, you know, which I've done here, I have to say, here.
Are you missing your dog?
Yes, I'm missing my dog.
Yeah.
So I made up the best dog that I could think of, and so it was a story that comforted me as I told it.
Mm. Yeah. And the dog brings people together.
Yes.
In the way that dogs often do.
Yes, yeah. Dogs do that. How many of y'all have dogs? Isn't that wonderful? How many have cats? Okay, let's keep on with the program.
I knew you were going to say something. So, of all the characters that you've written, are they all aspects of yourself, or is there one character in particular you feel is most like you?
I can see myself in all of the characters, but Raimi is the closest that I've come to putting myself on the page. That's me. That's who I was.
This is your true self.
Yeah, that's my true self.
And this is your most recent book, I think, isn't it?
Yes.
You haven't got anything since then?
No, I haven't. I've been asleep at the wheel since then.
We've been touring quite a lot.
I have. I toured a lot for this, yeah.
And what's it like meeting Australian readers? Is it different?
I was very nervous because I started off in Sydney at the Writers Festival, and Sally has done this too, where you do a full week of school days where the kids come in to auditoriums and you talk to them. And I was very nervous, thinking, well, what's going to happen? It's like it's an entirely different culture. And then I had a spectacular time, and it usually started with them laughing at me because I said y'all, and so then we were off and running, you know. And I cannot get rid of that. For a long time I worked at Disney World, and you move around large amounts of people at Disney World. So if you say to the large amounts of people, can I get you people to do me a favor, they won't. But if you say, could I get y'all to, and everybody just snaps to attention and just moves wherever you want them to move. So, yeah.
And is that just in the South or across the country?
Y'all is just a Southernism, but it's a Southernism that I have not gotten rid of.
Yeah. And what were some of the most interesting questions you got from some of the kids up in Sydney?
I got some questions that I have never gotten before. Some of them are exactly the same ones that the kids in the States asked me, but some of them had a real emotional acuity to them that that took me off guard. Because I talk about my father leaving, and they want to know the why of that and if I've seen him again. And they also, there's a point when I talked to the kids about when I was in the hospital, my father came to visit, and he brought me this gift, which was a red net bag filled with this little wooden world. It was a wooden sun, a wooden moon, a wooden farmer, wooden farmer's wife. And he spread those figures out on the sheets of my hospital bed and told me a story. And it was like this first conscious moment I had of what story could do. Mm. And then he asked me to tell him a story back. And so one of the kids stood up and said, what story did your father tell you with those wooden figures? And I answered her. And then she said, what story did you tell him back? Yeah.
Can you tell us?
Yeah. My father told me a story of the rooster marrying the pig and how much this upset the farmer.
And we wonder why you write animal characters.
Right. And then I told a story about the cow running away to the moon, which I felt was not as good as my father's, but it was good enough. And but I saw that I could do something, and I felt connected to him, and it made me feel less alone and less afraid. So it was my first conscious insight into story.
Yeah, fantastic. And I know a lot of kids are really curious about where writers get their ideas from. It's a question that I will always be asked. Mm-hmm. Is it? Do you think it's the same for everybody, or where do you get your ideas from?
Where do I get my ideas? It is an impossible question to answer. Mm-hmm. Generally, I say I eavesdrop, which of course is like cheating, but it is part of what I do.
Well, we cheat and we lie, don't we? We make up stories.
Right,
yeah.
Right. And I am always listening. Surely you're doing this too.
Yeah.
The world is fascinating. So I'm always staring and listening. I always have a notebook, and I never know what I'm going to see, and I never know what's going to go through my own mind. Mm. And so I try to stay open for whatever the thing is. And for me, a story will just start with a name or a phrase or an image. It's not, do you work?
So
do
just like a little seed.
Yeah. Do you outline?
No.
Yeah, right. Yeah, and I got into a real dust up with a teacher in a gymnasium in Connecticut when this little boy raised his hand and said, "You don't outline, but my teacher," pointing at her, "says I have to outline a story." So I like slowly turn and look at the teacher, and I go, "I don't want to get in the middle of your teaching methods, but I have to say that everybody does it differently. And yeah. If you had had me in your class as a fifth grader and told me I had to outline the story, it wouldn't have worked for me. Things got a little uncomfortable, but we got through it. Yeah.
And so you've got an idea, and then what happens there? You just flesh it out from there,
or then we go down to the coffee maker the early morning, and the finding your way through that half awake, half asleep mm-hmm. thing, and at the University of Minnesota, not that anybody's, you know, who knows if you're going to go to Minnesota or not. There's a collection there called the Curlin Collection where you can go and look at the rough drafts of children's books. The writers, I think people read Katherine Patterson here, Bridge to Terabithia. Mm. She's in there. The original art for Goodnight Moon is in there.
Wow.
And so you can go and just look at all of this. And I've been in the room when the director of the Curlin, she has a presentation she does where she uses the first page of the first draft of Because of Winn-Dixie. And invariably, these kids who grew up reading Because of Winn-Dixie and they're in college now will see this and just laugh themselves silly because it's almost incoherent. But I'd let it be that way. And then it acts as a rough map to get me to the next draft.
Mm. Yeah, so you're just feeling your way forward.
Yeah.
And this place of I guess daydreaming is quite essential, isn't it? And I have kids that I'm bringing up in the world, and I worry a little bit about how much of that time they fill. I'm not anti-screen by all means, but it does feel, even with myself, that I feel like I'm always filling up time, and mm-hmm. and that's almost like the antithesis to daydreaming or imagination, isn't it? Is that a challenge for you too, just to allow those blocks of time?
I tell myself this is your job, and so that's how I like put everything down, and I try to do this every afternoon. So that morning is for writing, and I'll allow myself an hour or two in the afternoon with a book and a notebook and a coffee shop somewhere where I don't know anybody. So for maximum staring and listening, and then to read somebody else's words mm-hmm. and to write in the notebook. And I think it's okay. This seems deeply pleasurable to me, but it is my job still, nonetheless. Yeah, yeah.
It's good. And sometimes you'll find too, and I'm talking to the younger people in the group here, you have to push through boredom sometimes, or that really restless mind. That's where the really good stuff comes, isn't
Absolutely.
It?
Yeah. And we're also, like you said, all of us are so now hooked to those things. And so mm-hmm. when I go to the coffee shop with the book and the notebook, I don't take the phone. Mm-hmm. It's just me and the book and the notebook and all the people who are unwittingly being spied on by me. Yeah, yeah.
So talking of screens, what was it like having your books made onto the big screen? Does it feel surreal? Or?
It's exactly that, surreal, because it's surreal enough that thing that you do in the early morning becomes a book, but then a movie is up there on the screen. What was in your imagination up there on the screen is just incredible. And it's also just one more thing, and you know this too, because writing is like letting go. And when it becomes a movie, you're letting go, and it's just going out into the world. And And I hate to say this, but movies are a fantastic advertisement for books. And so they bring so many people to the book that would not normally find their way there.
Yeah, it's true. And if they hated the movie, they can say the book was better. And if they love the movie, they'll go and read the book.
Yeah.
So win-win.
Sometimes a kid will stand up and go, did you like the book better or the movie better? And I say, it's a really difficult position you've put me in, but I'm going to have to say the book. Yeah.
It's a bit closer to you. Are you working on anything at the moment?
I am working on something. Will I tell you about it? No, I will not. Even if you threaten me, I will not talk about it. And you don't seem like a violent sort, but I have found that if I talk about it, I don't write it.
You jinx it a little bit.
I keep absolutely silent until about the fourth draft, where I start to think, am I crazy or does it make some kind of sense? And at that point, I'll show it to close friends who will tell me the truth. Yeah. They are just chomping at the bit to tell me the truth.
And sometimes I think kids can find it less daunting if they realize that. So everything you've written since Winn-Dixie, have you managed to get it published, or are there some that haven't? Oh, okay, sorry guys.
Yeah. There was one story that I wrote and sent to my editor. I mean, to my agent, and she said. She's got a very pronounced accent. I can't really do it very well. But what she said to me was, why don't we just put this in a drawer for a while? So that counts as rejection, right? It's like duly noted. In the drawer it goes. Yeah.
Fantastic. And I guess I'm going to open up to the floor for questions in a while, because I know that there'll be lots of them. But you were a little girl, you were a big reader, you never imagined you'd be a writer, you would look books on the shelf and never imagine that somebody actually made those things. Is it like what you imagined it would be?
Better? It's better than I imagined it would be. It's better because of the connection that it gives me. And I am still that shy kid that I was. And so it's always hard for me to go out into the world. But then I find how deeply satisfying it is to see the faces and to connect with the people who are reading the books. Would you say you're shy?
I think a lot of writers are extrovert and introverts, really.
Yeah, right. I mean, I've learned how to pretend to be an extrovert.
It's all about the pretending.
But I am an introvert. But it is, I have found that it is, it's way better than I ever imagined it would be. Yeah.
And what would you say for any young writers in here, what would be something that you would like them to take away with them? If anybody's feeling inspired that they'd like to become a writer, what do you think would be something that
young
like
writers,
to know?
Old writers, because I know that there are some people out there who are adults who still want to write. It's the same advice whether you're an adult or a kid. Read, and anybody who wants to write should be thrilled to get that assignment. And then you should find some way to make a deal with yourself about how you're going to do the work. And it is making a deal with yourself. And it does not have to be the same way that anybody else works, but you need to find the way that you can do the work. And then the last thing I would say is you have to kind of keep everything open. That means your mind and your heart and your eyes and your ears. Everything has to stay open, which is hard and also a huge gift if you can manage it.
We have a lovely writer in Australia, Isabel Carmody, who describes it a little bit like being a bit raw to the world. It's like your skin is quite porous.
Yes.
And you have to, which means that you often feel things quite intensely, but all of that has somewhere to go. And there's so much emotion and so much feeling in your stories. And do you think that that's the job of the writer, to really stay in touch with that part of themselves?
Yes, yes. And that's also the 10-year-old in me, happily. Yeah, so... Yeah.
Great. So beautiful. All right, let's have a few questions, because I'm sure there'll be lots of them. And there are some roving mics.
So wave your hand for a mic and they will come to you.
Yeah, there's someone at the front and someone at the back.
Hi, Kate, and welcome.
Oh, thank you.
I'd love to know why anybody would want to move from Florida to Minnesota, but that's not the question.
I can answer it, though, but that's fine. Okay, go ahead.
I would really like you to talk about rabbit holes. I would really like to hear about your personal journey to writing about Edward Tulane mm-hmm. and his miraculous journey.
Yeah, so Edward Tulane is the story of a rabbit doll, although Edward would object to the word doll, and who thinks that he is, as this little girl at a school in Florida said, all that and a bag of chips, and finds out that he's, you know, he learns to love. So where did the story come from, and what was my process with the story? I received as a gift from a friend a rabbit doll, and he's like about this tall, dressed in this very elegant outfit. And when the friend handed him to me, I said, what's his name? And she said, Edward. And I said, thank you very much. And I took him and I put him in on the couch in my living room. And then every time I walked into the living room, I screamed because he's a really creepy looking rabbit. He was sitting in there, and like I thought, I don't know if I can like have him in the house. He's creeping me out. And the third night I had him, I had a dream where he was underwater, face down on the ocean floor, with no clothing on. It's your basic naked rabbit dream, which I think all writers have them, right? I'm just the only one who's willing to sit up here and talk about it. And I thought that would be a beautiful picture book. So I started with that image, and this thing happened that will happen every now and then, where, and just to spoil you for the rest of the time, where the story just unfolded and told. It's just like I knew at the time that it was a gift. I was at least smart enough for that. I remember walking around the lake thinking, thank you, thank you, thank you, and it just told itself. And I was just along for the ride. I still have that rabbit. He's in my office. And I walk past him sometimes and say, you have been a very productive rabbit. And so it was a great gift. Yeah, so that's, yeah.
It's a great story.
Hi.
Hi.
What's your favorite book that you've written?
My favorite book that I've written. Do you have brothers and sisters? And do you have a parental unit here with you tonight? Where is that parental unit? Hello. Which of the children do you love the best? Did you see this? It was like this. Yeah. The books feel like my kids to me. So to pick a favorite is impossible because they're individuals, and I love them equally, but I love them differently. But the amount of love that I feel, I see them as deeply flawed but lovable anyway. You seem utterly perfect, but the books aren't. But I love them equally. Yeah.
Hi, you said that Raimi Nightingale, she describes you a lot. Is there any reason why you choose your own stories to write your stories? If you know what I mean.
I do know what you mean, and it's actually the first time that I've kind of used my story to tell my story, if that makes sense. I mean, I've told it obliquely before, which is like kind of like at an angle, but this is the first time that I've directly kind of used myself as the story. And I did it unwittingly. I did it without intending to, because that's a lot of what happens when you write. I have a writing teacher who says you write behind your own back. And so it wasn't until I was well into this book that I realized what I was doing.
Mm. Do you think that there's a part of yourself in everything you write, though?
Absolutely. Yeah, you can't, and you can't do it without putting your whole self into it, and you can't do it without revealing yourself unintentionally. Mm. Yes, yeah.
And you'll probably find that with everything you read, that every author has a lot of themselves in their books. I mean, even someone like J.K. Rowling will say Harry Potter is really just her. It's hard to see the connection. Young boy wizard, older female writer. But she knows what it's like to feel fear. She knows what it's like to have a crush on somebody. So those are the feelings that you channel and you put into your work.
Yeah.
Hi, Kate. My two daughters really enjoy your books, particularly The Tale of Despero. What I wanted to ask you was, a few weeks ago, I read in the newspaper that you experienced 473 rejections before getting your first book published.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just wondering what made you continue?
Yes, yes. How foolish am I? So what I talk in my presentation to kids about how, so 2 pages at a time I have stories and I start to send those stories out into the world. And then when you send stories to publishers, what do you get back? And it's always fun to say that to a room full of kids because invariably they will say money. And I go, no, there's like some... lots of steps in between. So they're like, the first thing that you get is a rejection letter. And so then we talk about rejection letters. And then I told them, I got a lot of rejection letters and asked them to guess. And generally they start, you know, guessing around 5 and then they'll go up to 15. And then, you know, they never go high enough. And then that number goes up there and there's this outraged gasp. And I say to them, which is true, every time I stand up here in front of this number, I think the same thing, which is, what would happen if I'd given up at 472? Mm. I wouldn't be standing up here talking to you. I would not be this person who has found what I'm supposed to do and gets to do it in the world. And so what made me keep going? I think it was this thing of thinking, I cannot make myself talented. And I can't make myself lucky. Those things are not in my control. But I can make myself do the work, and I can be relentless about putting the work out in the world. My mother always said that I was one of the most relentless people she had ever met. And so I chose to put my relentlessness there and just refused to give up. Mm. And I refused to give up, and I got lucky.
Mm. And were you writing for children back then, or was it the shift to writing
for children?
No, that
was almost all of those rejection letters were for short stories. When I started writing, I started with short stories. A lot of people do this, I think, thinking they're shorter, therefore they're easier, which, of course, is completely erroneous. And short stories in literary journals. But then what happened was I got a job in a book warehouse for a book distributor, and I was randomly assigned to the third floor of that warehouse, which was all children's books. It's what a friend of mine would call serendipity doodah. It's just I happened to end up there on that floor. And then as a reader, I started to read those books and fell in love with the form. Mm. So...
can you remember any of the books in particular?
Yes. Oh, yeah. There's a book, and I don't think that y'all know it here. It won the Newbery. it's called The Watsons Go to Birmingham, 1963. It was actually a Newbery Honor book by Christopher Paul Curtis. And I remember just exactly where I was standing when I read that book, and I thought, I didn't know that you could do this with a book that for kids, that you could write about something really important and it also could be funny and warm. And I thought, I want to try to do this.
Yeah. So great. Anyone else have a question? Yeah.
This is Audrey, and Audrey would like to know, what was the very first book that you wrote?
The very first book that I wrote was Because of Winn-Dixie. And that was also the very first book that got published. So before that, it was all stories. And then that was the first novel-length thing that I wrote.
Hi, Kate.
Hello.
Well, my personal favorite book that you wrote is Edward Tulane. I could relate to a lot of stuff in the story. I want to ask you, growing up, what was your favorite book as a child?
It is so hard for me to pick a favorite book as a child because I had different books that I would come back to again and again, and I was just reading. I would put up the top 10 Stuart Little. Have you read Stuart Little? I would come back to that one a lot, and The Mouse and the Motorcycle was one of my favorites. There's a mice theme there. And I loved Harriet the Spy. Mm. Do you know, anybody read Harriet the Spy? Mm-hmm. It's basically, I realize in retrospect, a handbook on how to become a writer. And I would come back to that one again and again. I loved Island of the Blue Dolphins. Mm. Anybody know that one?
Yeah.
Absolutely fantastic book. I loved Paddington. He deeply moved me, and I really wanted to go and visit Mr. Gruber and sit on a horsehair couch, and that's why there's a horsehair couch in Flora and Ulysses yeah. as a tip of the hat to Paddington and Mr. Gruber. So I just had a lot of different ones, and I loved The Borrowers. Mm-hmm. Anybody know The Borrowers? And I have come back to those as an adult, and they are just as fabulous as I remember them being.
And as ambassador for reading in the US, I think I'm not going to quote it properly, but you talk about reading connecting people. How does it feel for you when you meet a young girl in Australia that says that she can really relate to your characters?
Well, because I'm so old, it moves me to the point of tears. So it's deeply moving to think that's what a story can do. Mm. And stories do connect us. It's like there's something subterranean happens in a room when somebody's reading out loud, and it changes everybody. Just the act of listening together does.
Mm. Yeah.
How often is it that you go, wow, I just had a great idea, I'm going to go and write about it?
How often is it that I think, wow?
That's a great question.
I have a lot of really good ideas, and actually in that notebook that I always carry around, I have a running list that I transfer from one notebook to the next of those really good ideas. It's just turning the ideas into stories. And so every once in a while, I will have a day where I think this was a really good writing day. And I remember, and because of Winn-Dixie, there's a candy called Litmus Lozenge that makes you feel sad and happy at the same time. And I remember thinking, today is a good writing day. And actually, when my best friend read that story, she wrote, that must have been a good writing day. So every once in a while, you have a really good writing day where those ideas make it in. But for the most part, a lot of times I'll go back to the notebook with the good ideas, and I think, if I was a better writer, I could make these work. But I'll just have to keep on carrying them around until I'm a better writer. Does that make sense?
Hi, Kate. Just wondering if you can talk a little bit about whether you've studied the craft of writing or whether you're self-taught and whether you've got a mentor.
Sure. So I majored in English in college, and this is in the talk that I give to kids too. And I majored in English because then I could read all the time. And occasionally the adults would say to me, "What are you going to do with an English degree?" And I would go like, "Just let me read." And so I had then a professor in my senior year. I had taken an expository writing course, and he said to me, "You have a certain facility with words. You should consider graduate school." That's the direct quote. And I was 21, so what I heard was something like, "Wow, I've never met a writer like you. I think that you might be Eudora Welty, but I'm not certain." So I thought, why would I go to graduate school and do all that work if I'm so talented? So what happened was I got a black turtleneck, because that's what writers wear, and I sat around wearing the black turtleneck and telling everybody that I was a writer. And that was my writing school for about 9 years until I woke up and thought, wow, I could spend the rest of my life talking about this thing that I say that I want to do and not doing it. And so then I started to write with the 2 pages a day. I took some writing workshops in Minneapolis. But for the most part, I think most of us do this. You read, and then you teach yourself to write how? By writing, you know. So you have to do all the reading, because then you absorb the narrative arc, and that becomes a part of you. But the rest of it is like you finding your way through it. And it's wonderful if you've got a writing community that you can read to, but it is not necessary. You can teach yourself to do it by doing it.
And maybe those 473, I'm assuming that was quite a lot of short stories that were being sent out. Maybe
right, and all those short stories were kind of terrible.
That's all practice.
But they also taught me something, you know. And so by the time I thought I want to try to write a middle grade novel for kids, those short stories translated very well into writing chapters that had an arc to them, because I had the short story form down. Yeah.
Yeah, I was wondering when I was looking through some of the chapters, if that's the 2-page a day. Oh, that's a very short chapter.
Yeah, I love a short chapter. I love to read, but I love a short chapter because I like to feel like I'm getting things done. You know, it's like, yep, that's I read a lot of chapters today.
I know that sometimes it's kind of hard to stay on one topic. Mm-hmm. So how do you not get frustrated with one idea and go into a new story?
Right, and that's a very good question, because what I have found, and I wonder if this is true for you too, you're writing and it's like, geez, I don't know. And then you get another idea and you think, that's the book I should be working on. I'll just go over there and work on that book. And then this one, I'll come back to that later. And so what I have found is anytime I feel that kind of like reluctance or that I want to move to another story, I have to ask myself two questions. Are you afraid or are you lazy? And generally the answer is yes and yes. And so then I have to keep going. And every once in a while the story really I can't take it any further. But most of the time it's that I'm too afraid to push forward, or I just don't want to do the work of pushing mm-hmm. forward.
And have you ever managed to do a couple at the same time, or are you very focused just on the one?
I am focused on one and marinating. So I'll do one all the way through, let it sit, and for at least 2 weeks maximum, better if it's a month, and then come back so I can work on something short in between.
Yeah, great.
Hi.
Hi.
I was wondering if with your characters, do you try and like flow between the characters, like take character traits from one character and move them to the next one? Or do you come up with a new idea for every character?
Yeah, it's funny because there. I saw something recently where they wanted me to do a talk on how to form characters as if it was something that you would construct. And for me, it is not that way. They are people that I feel like I discover and then get to know. So I don't have to think about traits and moving them around. It's rather what I do, and generally for me, this is the only part of writing that is easy, is a name will come to me. So once I have the name, then I start to have the character, and then when I can get the character to talk to somebody else, then I start to figure out who the character is. And then things are going great, because I'm not in control anymore, and the characters are starting to talk, and then I figure out who they are.
Has anybody come up, any of your characters come up with some surprises?
Yes, that's what you're always waiting for, is the surprises. And, you know, it's just like when there are three girls in this book. I started off with one girl, and then all of a sudden here come Beverly Topinski and Louisiana Elefante, and it's just like I didn't anticipate them at all. You know, and I remember there's a book I wrote called The Tiger Rising, and there's a character in there named Sistine Bailey, and I remember when she climbed onto the bus, and I thought, wow, now I'm going to have to spend the rest of the novel trying to not let her take over. You know, it's just like she was so strong.
Right.
So, yeah.
Correct.
Yeah, they surprise you, don't they? Yeah.
I think we've got time for one more question. So, and anybody that's got a question that hasn't been asked, if you've got a book and you want to have it signed, I'm sure Kate can answer your questions then.
Or attempt to answer your question, yeah.
And spell their name right at the same time.
Yeah, right.
This is the lucky last question, I think.
Hi.
Hi.
What would you be doing if you weren't writing books?
Good question to end on. Wow.
I would be deeply unhappy. Yeah. I feel like I have found, like I said, the thing that I am supposed to do, and that I get to do it, and that I get paid to do it, seems to me like a miracle every day. This is it. For a long time, I told people to watch their step at Disney World, and that's, I still have that skill. I could go back to it. So the people would walk past me, and I'd say, look down and watch your step here, please.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I can still do that.
Well, I think not only are you a happier person for having become a writer, but we're certainly a happier place for you giving us these beautiful books to read. Okay. So can everybody please go take a look at our hands.
Thanks for listening to the Wheeler Centre podcast. Don't forget to visit wheelercentre.com for the best in books, writing and ideas from Melbourne, Australia and the world.